A quick warning before we start the show. Today's episode contains allegations and descriptions of sexual misconduct and assault.
We want to say that Deshaun Watson is innocent until proven guilty. How can you do business with a man that has 22 separate allegations of sexual misconduct levied against him? You have to acknowledge it does not look good. You have to acknowledge it looks very, very bad. The question is, what is the NFL going to do?
For weeks, the allegations against Deshaun Watson have played out through lawyer statements and in lawsuits filed under anonymity. But now, things are entering a new phase as some of Watson's accusers have spoken out publicly and support from some of his sponsors has evaporated. All while other women have come to his defense. Today, investigative reporter John Barr brings us the latest on the two dueling narratives surrounding Deshaun Watson and whether both can be true. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, April 15th. This is ESPN Daily. John Barr, thank you for joining me again.
Thanks for having me.
So we're talking to you on Wednesday, John, during the daytime. And I know that in the past day or two, we've seen some developments, notable developments in the Deshaun Watson case, specifically a statement from the attorney for Watson's accusers, Tony Busby. What was the news there and how significant was it?
The biggest news is that we will now know the names of all of the women who are suing Deshaun Watson. There was a court order last week that 13 of the women had to provide their actual names and could no longer sue under the pseudonym Jane Doe. Tony Busby agreed to release the name of a 14th, but now he has subsequently said that he will release the names of all of the women, with one exception. We now know that one of the women has decided to withdraw her lawsuit. And it's interesting to note that the woman who has decided to withdraw her lawsuit said that it was in light of privacy and security concerns that she's decided not to pursue her case for now.
John, the idea of alleged victims now stepping out into the public sphere, we saw that with Ashley Solis, who held a press conference last week. It was one of the more impactful moments in this saga. Can you explain and describe what took place there?
Yeah, Ashley Solis was the first person to file a lawsuit against Deshaun Watson. When Watson made a reference on the one and only public statement he's made, and that was his Twitter post, he made a reference to the attorneys for, he didn't identify the woman, but we now know it was Ashley Solis. They reached out in February and they asked for a $100,000 settlement. That was the information that Rusty Harden has put out there in a fairly detailed press release in an effort to sort of further the narrative that what Ashley Solis is really after is just money. But she gave a very impactful public statement during a press conference where she identified herself.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ashley Solis. Remember that name? I hope every woman or man out there who is a survivor hears my story.
You know, for weeks, these women had been known only by their pseudonyms, Jane Doe. And when she walked in, I think it added a layer of reality. That's when you realize that there are real people behind these allegations.
It has taken me a long time to get to this point, to come out publicly and speak my truth. I was afraid. I'm not afraid anymore, and I do exist.
Often broke down in tears while providing that statement.
Deshaun Watson is my assaulter and my harasser. Deshaun Watson assaulted and harassed me on March 30th, 2020, in my own home, doing what I love most, massage therapy.
She talked in great detail about how her hands shake whenever she provides a massage now and how Deshaun Watson has tainted the profession that she loves.
I can no longer practice the profession that I love the most without shaking during the session. My hands shake whenever I place them on a client and I've had to cut sessions short. Deshaun Watson has robbed me of that. He took that away from me. He tainted a profession in which I take enormous pride.
She wanted to stress that it was about far more than just money. It was about preventing Deshaun Watson from doing this to anyone else.
People say that I'm doing this just for money. That is false. I come forward now so that Deshaun Watson does not assault another woman. And I come forward now in the hopes that no other human being will assault another in the future.
Tony Busby is no stranger to the media. You know, he ran for mayor in Houston. We've talked before about what a colorful mm-hmm. figure he is. He's very skilled at using the media. And that was very much a moment designed for media impact. And I thought it was impactful. There's no getting around it.
I'm seeking justice, not just on behalf of myself, but for all survivors. I stand with you all. My name is Ashley Solis, and I am a survivor. Me too. Thank you.
And it led to an almost immediate response from Rusty Hardin.
What's really important is to understand the dangers of what's happened these last 2 weeks. Not just the dangers to Deshaun Watson, but the dangers to anyone in which an opponent decides to try to ruin because it will help their case.
It was after Ashley Solis spoke that Rusty Hardin came out with a very dramatic press conference of his own to try to take back the narrative and put his client in the best light.
All I know is we're supposed to start out with you assuming we did not do it. That presumption is pretty much gone in the way social media and all is used now. Because once the allegation is there, we know what, you can't take it away. People can make money back up if they lose money. What they can't get back is their reputation. That is the most destructive thing about what's happened here.
These women filed these lawsuits weeks ago, and yet, by and large, the companies that have endorsement deals with Deshaun Watson hung with him throughout. Mm. But the day after Ashley Solis provided her statement, you saw Nike, Beats by Dre, Reliant Energy, and others either suspending or ending their endorsement contracts with Deshaun Watson. So it was a powerful moment in this the arc of this story. And we could now, in theory, see other women come forward like Ashley Solis has done and put their faces out there in public and also tell their stories. And I don't think that the cumulative effect of that will be a positive development for Deshaun Watson.
One thing in that press conference, John, that really caught my ear in what Ashley Solis was saying was the line, quote, good guys can do terrible things.
We were all deceived into thinking Deshaun Watson was a good guy. And unfortunately, we know that good guys can do terrible things.
How did that line strike you?
You know, we had a story on ESPN's website earlier this week where I think we tried to seize upon that narrative that if these allegations are true, then you have to accept that there really are two Deshaun Watsons. You look at the good works that he's done in the community, and there's no denying it. You look at the incredible support he has from everyone, from the folks who knew him when he grew up in Gainesville, Georgia, to the people at Clemson, to the people, you know, with and around the Texans. This is a guy, if you're looking for supporters of Deshaun Watson, you will have no trouble finding them. There are many of them. And those people just can't fathom that he did anything like this. We let off our story by talking about this charitable drive that he did in late February in the Atlanta area. He showed up for a road rally, which was complete with like Ferraris and McLarens and all these really colorful sports cars, which kind of runs counter to his low-key, humble image. But the real intent of the road rally was to deliver two semi-truckloads of food to needy families in Gainesville, Georgia. And according to one of the organizers I talked to, they delivered enough food for 12,000 families, which is all great. And it's positive, and it's why people embrace Deshaun Watson so much. Well, a week later, according to the allegations in one lawsuit, he's back in Atlanta getting a $55 massage and, you know, touches the massage therapist with the tip of his penis, much to her shock. And she's now one of the ones who's suing Watson. So, again, it gets back to this whole concept that there, if these allegations are true, there really are two Deshaun Watsons.
John, I know that you yourself, you've been speaking to another accuser, someone going by the pseudonym of Mary. And Mary, unlike the other accusers, the other more than 20 accusers, Mary is not represented by Tony Busby, and she has not yet filed a lawsuit. Tell us about your experience interviewing Mary.
Yeah, so Mary, and give credit where credit is due, first reported by Sports Illustrated. Mary is a massage therapist in her late 20s in Houston. She has her own studio. She's worked her tail off to support herself, she says, for about the last 3.5 years. Watson, unlike in the other cases, did not reach out to her on Instagram. This other massage therapist referred Watson to her. She said about 45 minutes into the massage, much to her surprise, Watson threw the towel on the floor and was completely naked in front of her. She's done more than 1,000 massages, and she said that that has never happened. Mm-hmm. You know, Rusty Harden said in his press conference that it wasn't unusual for people to be nude during a massage. Well, that might be true. Underneath some sort of covering, they've never, you know, it is, I can tell you that talking to more massage therapists than I'd ever thought I'd talk to, It is not typical for someone to be completely nude and uncovered on a massage table during a professional massage. That is just outside the realm of what's normal and acceptable behavior. She said she was shocked when that happened, but just told herself, look, just be professional, don't react to it, finish the massage, get him out of my office. That's what she says was going through her mind. At the risk of being too graphic, as the massage went on and approached conclusion, she said he became sexually aroused and almost started thrusting as if he was like humping the air. She said she told him to calm down. At one point, she said she noticed that there was a bodily fluid on his stomach. The massage ended. He left, and she immediately, on the way home, called her older sister, who we also interviewed. And her older sister recalled Mary sounding distraught, and she recounted to her precisely what I just described to you. And then there were a few occasions in the months that followed where Watson actually reached out to her on Instagram. Huh. And we've reviewed those Instagram messages, and we've confirmed that they come from his verified Instagram account. And it kind of became apparent to her when he reached out in November of this past year that he was unaware that she had provided him a massage in the past. She reiterated to him that she required full sheet draping during massages. And she also said to him in their first exchange that he made her uncomfortable in their first massage. And he replied, and I'm paraphrasing, but something along the lines of, you know, my bad, that wasn't my intention. And that was the end of it. He just never booked a massage. And then there was yet another time when he reached out through Instagram and wound up never booking a massage. But all of this happened in the fall of 2019, which would make Mary's case the earliest case that we've heard about.
As you spoke with Mary, John, and obviously there is, per the accounting of her sister, a contemporaneous accounting that would speak to how impactful this was on her. But what did she describe in terms of what this left her with in terms of the impact on her personally?
Yeah, she was disgusted by it. She said that more than anything, her shock gave way to anger. She just felt really disrespected. And you know, when I asked her, well, what do you want? Like, what would give you some measure of justice or ability to find some closure with this whole episode? And she said she wants an apology. She wants an apology not only for her, but for her profession. It just makes her mad that, and these are her words, not mine, that Deshaun Watson, somebody who has, you know, incredible wealth, somebody who could have anything he wants, would treat women who are professionals in this manner. And she just feels really disrespected above all else.
Has Deshaun Watson's camp responded to Mary's story, John?
No, they have not. Rusty Harden has said it's almost unfair to ask them to respond to an anonymous allegation. And look, she hasn't filed a police report. She hasn't filed a lawsuit. She has an attorney. She did at one point reach out to Tony Busby's office, but she told us that she felt pressured to sign as a client and just didn't feel like a good fit. But she has retained counsel. She has UA Lewis, this civil rights attorney in Texas, representing her.
Okay, John, after the break, I want to look at how being a part of this case is impacting these women and what comes next for them and Deshaun Watson and the NFL.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
John, you've already walked us through the specific stories of both Ashley Solis and of Mary, but when you pull back and you look at all the accusations here as a whole, and we have more than 20 different accounts now, what's the general pattern being alleged against Deshaun Watson?
Well, based on the lawsuits that we've read that were filed by Tony Busby's clients, based on Mary's accounts, generally speaking, he would reach out to these women on Instagram. There are allegations that he would, in some instances, tell the massage therapist what he wanted them to wear. There's at least one instance where he went to great lengths to get a massage. He reached out to a massage therapist in the Atlanta area, flew her to Houston. There are Instagram message, direct message exchanges that Tony Busby has made available to reporters where you can see Watson sending this woman her flight itinerary. She didn't have a massage table. There's one exchange where she says, "Fine table? Question mark." And he responds, "Yep, got one from my team." She met him at the Houstonian Hotel. And the allegations differ in terms of the level of sexual contact and inappropriate conduct. But all of these allegations uniformly talk about Watson getting sexually aroused. There are a few women who allege that he forced them to perform oral sex. Watson's legal team has acknowledged that there were sex acts during these massages, but that all of them were consensual. In those instances where sexual activities alleged to have occurred, it was always consensual. Mm. Rusty Hardin used the words mutually desired.
On some occasions, some sexual activity would have taken place. I'm not going into what it is or how, you know, the nature or the numbers or with whom, but I think you can rightfully assume that. The question always that we have always been emphasizing, never at any time, under any circumstances, did this young man ever engage in anything that was not mutually desired by the other party.
One thing that Watson's legal team has offered, John, in response is these statements from other massage therapists that Watson's worked with, and you've spoken with a number of those women as well. What did you learn from those statements and from your conversations?
Yeah, so Rusty Hardin's legal team, Watson's legal team, put out statements from 18 women who've massaged Watson more than 130 times over a 5-year period. And to a person, those women say he never did anything inappropriate. He was always respectful. He never did anything that could even remotely be construed as make a sexual advance. He was humble, quiet. We've spoken with 5 of those women, and it is interesting when you speak directly to those women to see the details that did not appear in their statements or the information that was released to the media.
Like what?
Well, I spoke with one woman, for example, Masako Jones. She's 39. She's a massage therapist in the Houston area. And she told me that there were a few occasions where Watson, again, not to be graphic, developed an erection during the massage. Now, she said it was not anything sexual. She said that happens sometimes. Massage therapists will tell you that when they are trained that if indeed that happens, you should just focus on another part of the body, you know, and just move on. She described it as an involuntary reaction. And again, nothing sexual in nature. Another woman I spoke with told me that she massaged Watson 3 times in Atlanta. It became clear to me when interviewing her and others that they really hadn't read the lawsuits. They'd seen media reports, but they weren't really aware of what these women are alleging. So when I made her aware of the nature of the allegations, she said, well, look, I'm not saying that what these women are saying isn't true. They should be able to speak their truths, just like I should be able to speak mine to provide some level of balance. And that kind of stands in contrast to what yet another massage therapist said in support of Watson. There are some who've just flat out come out and said that they don't believe these women who are accusing Watson are being truthful. So the larger point is that there are plenty of massage therapists who are ready to provide testimony in support of Deshaun Watson to communicate the point that he did not behave inappropriately during massage sessions.
John, something that I'm curious about is just the sheer number of therapists that Deshaun Watson is not disputing at this point that he has worked with. What did the women that you spoke to from this group, what do they have to say about that?
Most people you speak with, athletes, massage therapists, they're surprised that, you know, most professional athletes have, you know, a person or a few people that they typically lean on for massage therapy. If you add up the 18 women who came out in support of Deshaun Watson, the 22 women who have filed lawsuits against him, and then Mary, you know, that's north of 40 women who are saying that Watson received massages from them in recent years. Rusty Harden said at his most recent press conference that Watson was getting 2 to 3 massages a week. And look, that's not unusual. NFL players get banged up, and it is typical for a lot of them to get massage therapy, particularly after games, but even before games. So it's not unusual that he would get that many massages, but it is unusual that he would have that many massage therapists.
So, John, these statements from these women who are now coming out in support of Deshaun Watson, what kind of an impact do you think that's going to have on this case?
Well, look, they're significant character witnesses. You know, this activity is alleged to have occurred during massage therapy sessions. And so if Rusty Harden can put 18 women in front of a jury, potentially, to provide a very different narrative about what went on during those massages, it could be very powerful testimony. But, you know, it should be noted that the statements of all of these women, the women who've come out in support of Deshaun Watson, the women who are suing Deshaun Watson, they're about to be placed under the microscope. Anything these women have said via text messages or with people privately, that's all fodder for attorneys to question in the course of a civil lawsuit through the course of discovery. And I think we can anticipate that these women will have their lives very much placed under a microscope. And that's no small thing, especially for women who allegedly have been sexually assaulted.
John, you noted there the great deal of scrutiny that these women are under, and that would seem to apply to women on both sides of the case. How would you characterize the kind of impact, the burden this case is having on the women involved?
Well, according to court filings on behalf of Ashley Solis, who, of course, was the first woman to go public in a press conference, Solis has received death threats and graphic death threats. People talking about wanting to see her in a ditch. People, you know, using all manner of profanity to insult her. And these death threats have come in the form of emails and also through messages on social media. So it's interesting that the one woman who decided to withdraw her lawsuit cited privacy and security concerns, and you can only wonder if perhaps she was aware of the reaction that Ashley Solis received once she went public.
But I want to get also, John, to this idea of mutual exclusivity, this idea referring back to that quote about a good guy doing bad things, that there is a world in which all of this might be true, allegedly.
Yeah, the thing about it is just because Deshaun Watson behaved appropriately during a massage therapy session doesn't mean that he didn't behave inappropriately during a massage session. Both of those things can be true. But the onus is now on Tony Busby and these women to prove that in court. And look, keep in mind, we don't know how many cases are being investigated by Houston police. That's the other part of this equation. There, you know, in addition to all of these civil cases, there's a criminal investigation that's going on. And the burden of proof there, of course, if a prosecutor ever gets to the point where they're weighing whether or not to charge Watson, will be guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. That's much different than a civil case where the standard is preponderance of the evidence, which means if the scales tip, you know, 50.1% in favor of finding for the plaintiffs, you know, that's just a different legal standard. It's easier to meet.
What about the NFL investigation, John? We know the league's been looking into this themselves. What do we know about the timeline, the status of that investigation?
To my knowledge, they have not interviewed any of Tony Busby's clients or Deshaun Watson at this point. But Deshaun Watson's attorney, Rusty Harden, has signaled that Watson will cooperate with any and all investigations, the NFL's investigation, any police investigation. My colleague Ed Werder has made the point that the commissioner's exempt list is generally speaking designed to suspend players from practicing or playing games. And right now, the Texans aren't doing either of those things. The league has a little bit of leeway just given the NFL calendar to let this thing play out a little bit. The commissioner doesn't really have to make a decision right now. You could see the commissioner suspend Watson even before an investigation runs its course. But yeah, at this point, to my knowledge, Deshaun Watson and the women who are involved in this have not been interviewed by the league, but that doesn't mean that won't happen in the coming weeks.
So in terms of the idea of resolution before the new NFL season starts in September, John, is that realistic to you, the idea that this could have an ending by then?
It's possible. It's always possible that all of these women will settle as a group. It's possible some of them may settle individually. Remember, these are individual lawsuits that are being filed. But it's also possible that this could drag out for several months. You know, sometimes civil cases go on for years. You know, this is, I think it's been sort of characterized by a lot of people as a series of he said, she said cases, but it's more than that. There are all a number of witnesses associated with each woman's story who in theory could be called before the court to provide testimony. So it's going to be up to the attorneys and the legal teams for the plaintiffs and the legal team for Watson to sort through all that. And that's going to take some time.
John Barr, thank you for breaking down a complex story, and I have a feeling we'll be talking to you again.
You bet.
A quick postscript. Late Wednesday, an additional lawsuit was filed against Deshaun Watson by a Houston area makeup artist, accusing him of sexual assault and harassment during two massage sessions allegedly arranged over Instagram at his home in September and November of 2020. Additionally, a report from the Washington Post claims that five of the women who filed lawsuits against Watson have also spoken with Houston police. Coming up, on the night of the WNBA draft, Kevin Pelton tells us why we won't be seeing some of the biggest names in women's college hoops.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. The WNBA draft is tonight, and you'll almost certainly see Charlie Collier, the junior forward out of the University of Texas, taken number one overall by the Dallas Wings. But after a women's NCAA Final Four that drew a record audience, you won't see some of the biggest names from the tournament, as you might if this was the NBA draft. You're not going to see Paige Beckers, you're not going to see Caitlin Clark, and that's because those two players just finished their freshman seasons, and the rules for going from college to pro are super different for the WNBA. Kevin Pelton recently wrote about all those differences on ESPN.com, so I called him up to discuss. Kevin Pelton, this has been a really banner year for women's basketball, it feels like. The tournament was excellent. We got to know some really enormous names in the process, but those are names we're not going to be hearing tonight at the WNBA draft, and I needed you to walk me through the entry rules that explain why that's unfortunately so.
Yeah, it's very different than the NBA draft, where we see Jalen Suggs in the Final Four, and then a couple months later, he's going to be drafted with, you know, one of the top five picks. And the key difference here is in the WNBA, if you play in college, if you're an American player, the ways you can become eligible are either if you turn 22 during that calendar year, naturally, if your graduating class, your four-year class is graduating, or if you're set to graduate within the current quarter or semester. So there's some ability for players to come out after 3 years of college if they turn 22 that year or they graduate early. But otherwise, it's a full 4 years, very different than the NBA.
So this means we're not going to get Paige Beckers. We're not going to get Caitlin Clark on our broadcast tonight, not as draft picks. How does that feel to you? Are you disappointed by that? Would you like to see a change in the rules to enable them to go one and done after their freshman years?
I think I am. I mean, you know, I come at this obviously from the NBA perspective, where we've had one and done ever since there was an age limit at all above, you know, finishing high school or being age 18. And there I would even probably like to see it go back to where everybody is eligible coming out of high school at age 18. So to not have that option at all until at least 3 and often 4 years of college does feel a little bit limiting for those players to me.
Yeah, and I know that you've done research in the past about the NBA being a really almost surprisingly good incubator and developer of young talent. The wisdom used to be that you had to go to college to really learn the game. The NBA, your research has indicated, seems to actually do a pretty good job of that. What's your sense of what that could be like for the WNBA? How does that concern emerge?
I think it's a little trickier for a few reasons. The league is not really set up to encourage development. You know, you've got smaller rosters, first off, only 12 teams, 12 roster spots apiece. It's very difficult. I think it's possible that less than 10 players drafted tonight might end up on rosters when we get to opening day in a few weeks here. So that's challenge number one, certainly. And, you know, I think expansion is inevitably part of this talk if you want to talk about expanding that player pool in the WNBA. But the other aspect is you don't have as large coaching staffs with as many coaches devoted to player development. You don't have a minor league as the NBA has created with the G League to develop players during the season. And you've got this shorter window during the regular season of, you know, 4 months or so that teams are typically together. And then players go off and typically play overseas the rest of their year. So it's very different setup than the NBA.
And I don't want to disrespect Charlie Collier, for instance, who's the presumptive number one pick tonight out of Texas. I think she's fantastic. I know, for instance, Kiana Williams out of Stanford, who won the title. She's going to be a big name to know. Ari McDonald, of course, who took that buzzer beater against Stanford for Arizona, who was her own star, this comet in the tournament. They're all great. But what if Paige Beckers and Caitlin Clark were to come out this year, Kevin, in this hypothetical alternate universe, how would they do, according to your research, as rookies in the WNBA?
Yeah, I think they'd be ready to contribute right away in terms of what you saw from them as freshmen. And one of the interesting things about this year's draft class in particular is, you know, the translations that I do from players' college performance to the WNBA, what the equivalent would be when you adjust for strength of schedule. It was a long way down before you got to one of the seniors as the best translations in this year's class. And there's, you know, both of those freshmen ahead of any of the seniors in this year's draft. So Clark, with you look at the huge numbers she put up at Iowa, where she was playing this enormous role, 37% usage rate, nearly double the average player. That projected to, if she was playing starters minutes in the WNBA, about 14 points and 6 assists per game, which is pretty impressive, obviously, for a rookie. Paige Beckers, you know, her per game stats, not necessarily as impressive, closer to, you know, 10 points and 4 assists. But I think her value in some ways goes beyond that with both her efficiency as a shooter and her ability to run a team.
You talked to Sue Bird for your reporting on this story, and I was ultimately totally understanding of why this is so, but I was a little bit staggered by it. It's the idea that it's actually in the player's financial interest to maybe stick around college, which is just so different, Kevin, from the NBA.
Right, because they do benefit in this case, I think, a great deal from the brands that are UConn and the other powers in women's basketball, where, you know, in some ways, those ties are stronger than they are to the individual players that we see as stars in the WNBA. And that's, you know, kind of been one of the challenges for the WNBA over time, is how do we convert all this excitement that we see over March Madness and the way that the women's NCAA tournament has grown, albeit often without the support of the NCAA, as we talked about a lot in March, and how do we convert that into fandom for the WNBA?
So the CBA and the WNBA Players Union, they're the ones who have to push the issue of getting rid of age limits if this is going to become a reality. What have they done so far on that, and do you see that approach changing?
Yeah, and that's where a number of people who are part of the WNBA's Leadership Council, including Sue Bird and the president of the Players Association, Nneka Ogwumike, were asked about this. And they basically admitted that it wasn't their top priority when they were negotiating this most recent CBA that took into effect last season. Early entry wasn't necessarily at the forefront. And I think that could change as you look ahead to negotiations on the next CBA, but that's going to be a while. It wouldn't take effect until at the very earliest before the start of the 2026 season.
So the season that we just had, wrapping up in 2021, has been, it seems, a high point, Kevin, in terms of people paying attention and investing into women's basketball. What have you seen as somebody who follows the sport so closely as a reporter and a fan? What have you seen as we head into the 25th season of the WNBA in terms of that change writ large?
Yeah, it's a lot more part of the zeitgeist than it was a few years ago. And thankfully, when you tweet about the WNBA now, there's fewer trolls in your mentions. That's certainly a positive. But, you know, it's just a much greater part of the conversation. And I give credit to a younger generation that I think has grown up with the WNBA and doesn't see it as this novel thing, but has just been used to, you know, there's men's professional basketball and there's women's professional basketball. And one takes place during the winter and the spring, and one takes place during the summer. And they're both part of the conversation.
Kevin Pelton, thank you for always risking the trolls in your mentions whenever you jump on ESPN Daily.
Hopefully it won't be too bad after this, Pablo. Thanks.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.